Seeing that he intended to remain standing there, Colfax said, "Who's on first? Claire?" Pascal delivered a clear, economical report, at the end of which Colfax said, "You think Slabman is Donna Crowther's boyfriend?" There it was. Slabman had made it back to base already. "Could be," all said. "Could be the third corner of a triangle. Or it's someone totally unrelated to either of them." "And he was shot?" "Dr. Berg thinks so. Shot somewhere else, then buried. Run a detector over the whole yard. You never know." "Underway," all said. "And the original house was pulled down? Pity. It might have been the crime scene. The whole shebang. Blood, DNA, prints, shell casings, the bullet itself." She paused. "Stating the obvious. Someone has to." Colfax gave him a look. Was he being a smartass? Claire Pascal cut in. "The daughter of the woman who owned the house is probably still around, boss. Talk to her. Soon. She might have seen something. Blood, signs of cleaning, painting or plastering." "Will do." "Speculating for a moment," Colfax said, "why would you hide a body under a slab rather than dump it somewhere?" Asking for speculation was one of her tactics. Dutifully, all said, "To stage a disappearance." And Claire said, "Conceal a link to the killer. Conceal forensic evidence, manner of death, for example. Throw us off the scent." "Inspirational," Helen Colfax said, "seeing two powerful minds at work. Throw us off what scent?" "Killer and victim were involved in something illegal," Claire said. "They attracted unwanted attention and one of them panicked." "Or got greedy," all said. "Okay. See what the local plods have to say. If anyone remembers back that far. Why a slab? Why not just a hole in the ground?" "A slab will sit there for years," all said. "Who wants to dig up a slab?" "But laying a slab takes time and effort. And knowledge and, you know, cement, etc." "This is a quiet back road, boss," Claire said. "No traffic. An old house set back from the road, plenty of privacy, and potentially plenty of time. Anyone who's done a bit of do-it-yourself patching up of a wall or a veranda knows how to mix concrete," all said. "Okay," Colfax shrugged. "Ask around about this Crowther woman. How strong was she? Was she the backyard blitz type? Did she have help?" all said. "So on and so forth," Helen Colfax said, concluding the briefing. All returned to his desk and went online. If the configuration of numbers and letters scrawled on John Elphick's notebook was a number plate, then it was probably Tasmanian. He clicked the contact link on the Tasmanian Roads Department site and emailed a query. Then it was 5:30 p.m., and he'd promised to collect Pia Fanning from after-school care. He took a tram back across town to the university and walked through the side streets to the gates of her primary school, where he waited with a handful of others, mothers, the odd father, and grandparent. He didn't talk, and no one talked to him. They barely knew him. He'd rarely had the opportunity to walk Pia to school or pick her up. Besides, she'd only been at this school for 3 or 4 months. Suddenly, she was there, hugging him around the waist. 10 years old, a tall, pale, mostly silent child. Seemingly 90% elbows and knees. "A.A.," she called him now, which he considered a good sign. When she first moved into Chateau Hall with her mother, she'd been timid as a mouse. "Learn much today?"
"Not a thing."
"Excellent." He walked, she skipped, in the general direction of his house on Drummond Street. "Ice cream?" They got ice creams. And then all was putting on his conspiratorial voice and murmuring, "Incoming," meaning pedestrians. And he and Pia stood stock still, taking up 2/3 of the footpath, while a straggle of 3 approached, heads down, thumbs working at their phones. "Mayhem and chaos," murmured all. "Total head-on collisions." Pia narrowed her eyes.
"Uh-huh. They have, like, feelers. They can sense us."
One collided. 2 looked up and veered away at the last moment. All were deeply affronted. 1 out of 3's not too bad, all said.
You've done worse.
Then, as they neared the house, her playfulness evaporated, and she seemed to shrink. Glued herself to all side, her steps growing smaller, slower. To cheer her up, all said, "People free day tomorrow. No school."
"I'm going to Dad's tonight,"
Pia replied, barely audible. All had been told a fair bit about the father, but hadn't yet met him. "He's picking you up?"
"Yes."
"What time?"
"He said 6.
"Okay.
I'll have to pack. I won't have time to watch crap TV with you."
An anxious child made more anxious. "Do we watch crap TV?" asked all lightly.
"That's what you call it."
All reflected that Pia had been badly in need of crap TV when she moved in. Anxious, solemn, barely knew what fun was. They reached the house. Chateau Hall was a 3-story tenement built during the boom that followed the 1850s gold rushes, and was at the end of a row of 4. The other 3, home to a lawyer, a celebrity professor, and a pair of surgeons respectively, were well kept. Hall's was scruffy, without quite being a disgrace, apart from the footpath wall. Thigh-height, crumbling brick, it leaned inwards and enclosed a narrow front garden of weeds, random litter, and dying rose bushes. He'd drawn up a roster, but no one paid it any attention, so he was the one to clean the little patch of its accumulated cigarette butts, empty wallets, supermarket bags, and the occasional tiny sock or children's shoe. Eyeing the front yard critically, he opened the gate. "A McDonald's bag this afternoon." He picked it up gingerly and offered it to Pia. "Yum."
"Ew."
"I grew up in a hole in the road," he told her. After many weeks of sharing a house with him, she was familiar with the old routine, but she didn't respond this time. Heart not in it. All unlocked the front door, a massive slab of wood painted black and decorated with a tarnished brass knocker. Tossed his keys into the bowl on the hall table and told Pia to make herself a snack. Then he dumped his wallet in his room, a vast, silent, high-ceilinged chamber with a king-size bed taking up the center and a massive wardrobe brooding against one wall. He'd inherited bed, wardrobe, and house when his parents died. Then he opened the curtains and window, admitting air just south of toxic, stepped back into the hall and headed down to the kitchen. A med student occupied the first room after his. He rarely saw her. Then a small room with a spare bed, piled with junk, followed by the shared bathroom, the sitting room, the kitchen, the laundry. Beyond all that was a little suite of rooms, 2 tiny bedrooms and a mini bathroom. Known to the household as Doss Down, it faced the tiny concreted backyard and alleyway fence, and was cast in a permanent shadow by the terrace row behind Alls. He'd lived in it during his teenage years. It was the furthest distance from his parents' bedroom, and offered a covert way in and out via the alley. But now it housed waste and strays. The tradition began early in Alls' married life, when Liz's sister-in-law left her husband and needed a place to stay. Then, when she'd sorted herself out, one of Orr's nephews moved down from Sydney to go to RMIT and stayed for a semester before he found himself a student hovel. And it went on from there. Schoolmates of his daughter, fleeing trouble at home, old friends between jobs, an aunt from the bush recuperating after surgery. And lately, women and kids escaping abusive partners, like Neve and Pia Fanning. All poked his head into the shared kitchen. Pia was there, smothering bread in Nutella and pouring juice into a glass. He stepped back into the hallway and listened. Above him were 2 floors and a complex arrangement of stairs, landings, and rooms. His student daughter, Beck, lived at the top, sharing a bathroom with a visiting Sri Lankan biochemist and her husband, who rented a bedroom and a study on the same corridor. Liz lived on the middle floor when she was in town. She had a bedroom, a study, a tiny sitting room, and a bathroom. All those rooms, all those residents. But the house was silent just now. No voices, devices, floorboard creaks. All called out anyway, hands making a megaphone around his mouth. Honey, I'm home! Presently a muffled clatter, and Beck peered down from the upper landing. She held Cynthia the cat to her chest, freeing one hand long enough to waggle her fingers at her father.
You're home early?
No, I'm not, she said.
Well, what would all know? His hours were a mess, and so were hers.
Lectures, boyfriends, part-time work in a Lygon Street gift shop.
You in for dinner? He called.
She shouted yes and disappeared again.
To be loved and needed, cried all.
Cherish it!
All realized he was hungry. He poured a beer, placed a slice of cheese on a slab of bread, and sat at the wrought iron table in the backyard. Some school kids walked by on the other side of the alley fence. The jasmine was dying off. Distant cars and voices on the mild spring air. Jet streams above. Still hungry, he returned to the kitchen just as the front door knocker started to reverberate like gunshots along the hall. Pierre's father? All answered the knock. Found a bulky man on the front step. A towering, soft-looking figure. Rolls of flesh above the collar of an expensive grey suit.
Can I help you?
All semblance of softness vanished the moment the man opened his mouth. Tell Pierre I'm here. Didn't introduce himself. Barely registered all. Simply turned around to survey the street. Tapped his polished toe cap. Shot his sleeve to check his watch. Busy man.
And you are?
All asked. Just to be a prick.
Me?
Lloyd Fanning swung his great, truculent head around. I'm her father, dipshit. I've got her for 3 days, or didn't the slag tell you? He thinks I'm sleeping with Neve, Orr thought. He opened his mouth to speak, but Fanning ploughed on. I haven't got all day, traffic's going to be murder. Fanning had stayed on in the marital home, and he was dead right. Peak hour down to Geelong, the traffic would be murder. Orr walked back through the house, knocked on the DOS down door. Pia? Your dad's here. And off she went, meek and silent. An unhappy little girl with a well-dressed brute. Chapter 6 By 7 p.m, all had cooked tagliatelle in one pot, bolognese sauce in another. He prepared 2 bowls of the mix, called up to Beck and took his dinner through to the sitting room, where he ate on his lap, watching the ABC News with Cynthia curled hard against his thigh. Beck clomped down eventually, kissed the top of his head, and stood behind his armchair, drawn to the movement on the screen.
Where's Pia?
Gone to her father's.
Neve?
Still at work.
Did Mum get away okay?
All said,
yes.
Beck patted his shoulder. An action she'd repeated many times since her parents split. Conveying infinite sorrow, hers included. But the pat also said, I'm okay. You're okay. Everything's okay. All joined her in the kitchen to chat and watch as she reheated her pasta in the microwave. Filled a glass with water. Threw torn up lettuce into a bowl and dripped olive oil and balsamic vinegar over it.
See, Dad? Greens. Roughage?
Impressive. She was reddish blonde, with a keen, narrow face. Slight, but not fragile. Capable of fierce judgments or raucous humour, but mostly equable and focused. Black leggings and a loose white t-shirt, nothing on her feet. Silver here and there. Fingers, ears, one nostril. Then she was trudging upstairs again. Such was the pattern of all's life. Absent-minded love. Reasonable stability. A few secrets. The best possible outcome of his mistakes and inattention. Not in the mood for crap TV. all curled up in an armchair and read an exquisitely written novel in which nothing happened. He was about to hurl it across the room when the front door opened and closed with a soft click. Neve Fanning appeared from the hallway.
"Oh, Alan,"
she said, sounding, as usual, tentative, discomposed and surprised to see him. "Neve," said Orr. "Hungry? There's leftover pasta." A thin, tense, worn-out woman of 34. Neve Fanning ducked her head shyly.
"No, thank you."
She paused.
"Any word from Pia?"
"No. Should there be?" Neve hovered, expressing apology and neediness, then disappeared into Doss Down. All was betting she wouldn't come out again. Didn't want to be a burden, she'd said, the day she moved in. Her footprint was pretty small. Used a laundromat on Lygon Street. Never took long showers. Never left lights on. She worked at the university, cleaning. Irregular shifts. The only job she could find after moving to the city. She insisted on paying rent. All insisted it wasn't necessary, and that meant there was now about $1,500 in the Neve and Pia Fanning emergency kitty. It had taken her weeks to trust him. He knew some of the story from Liz. Back when it was all going to hell in the All marriage, Liz, a Ministry of Housing bureaucrat, sought a transfer to Geelong, where she helped set up HomeSafe, a community housing agency for victims of family violence in the southwest region of the state. On the day Neve and Pia came in seeking emergency accommodation, all of the HomeSafe properties were occupied. "Why don't you move up to Melbourne?" Liz suggested. "Away from your pig of a husband. More job opportunities." Chateau Hall with its little apartment out the back. After a few weeks in residence, Neve Fanning began haltingly to confide in Hall. "No one really knows what goes on behind closed doors," she said one evening. She wanted him to coax it from her. Hall obliged, deploying a professional dexterity in the techniques of coaxing and grilling. Neve Fanning, Pia Fanning, Lloyd Fanning. Lloyd was an accountant, Neve a homemaker. Pia was at primary school, and the little family appeared to lead a charmed life in a spacious house in Manifold Heights, one of the better suburbs of Geelong. "Everyone thought I was so lucky," Neve said. "Married to a great guy. Successful, well-educated, life of the party, knew all the right people." She shrugged. "A nice house here, another in Bali." But Lloyd Fanning had a temper. Liked to punch and kick Neve, throw her against walls and over tables and chairs, hold a knife to her throat. Once when Pia was watching. Not to mention the belittling and controlling. "One year when I was at a Christmas lunch with the other school mums, he came and got me. Dragged me out, saying I couldn't trust those bitches. It was just him and me." He didn't allow her to keep a job or make new friends or see her family. She had no money of her own, and he'd scroll through her emails, her mobile phone call log and texts, needing to know who she'd been in contact with. When he wasn't with her, he'd call, text, up to 50 times a day. Eventually, Neve found the courage to apply for a one-year intervention order. She left Lloyd and took Pia to live with her elderly parents in Corio. Under the provisions of the IO, Lloyd Fanning's time with his daughter was tightly supervised. But when the order lapsed, Neve didn't apply for another. Ducking her head as she told all this, as if expecting him to disapprove, she said, "Lloyd was really trying to make an effort. And it is important for Pia to have a relationship with him. You went back to him." She shook her head. "I thought about it, and God knows he put the hard word on me. But in the end, I didn't." And so Lloyd took his revenge, by way of his daughter. He broke promises, cancelled plans at the last minute, arrived late, returned Pia long past her bedtime. Once, when he took Pia to Bali for a holiday, he hired a nanny and left her to it. Ignored her for 10 days.
And the way he spoke to me and my poor parents, if it was his turn to have her. Threatening, arrogant. Or he'd sit out in his car and toot the horn. Poor Pia, she'd get in such a state. Neve shook her head. She started wetting the bed. Neve, her parents, her daughter, all terrified. So Neve had applied to HomeSafe for emergency accommodation and to legal aid for help in obtaining a no-contact order through the family court. The HomeSafe application led her to Allshouse. The legal aid visit was more disappointing. The lawyer told me no-contact mums are seen as malicious and I'd need much stronger grounds than just Lloyd being rude or destructive. Neve, he hit you. She ducked her head again. Anyway, I've asked for restricted time. Until that was granted, Lloyd continued to see Pia when it suited him. He'd also hired a very expensive lawyer. That was 3 months ago, and in the early days, the DOS Down suite of rooms was the Fannings' cave. They hid there for hours. All understood. All those weird strangers in the other rooms. All himself. But it went deeper than that, and all came to realize how unprepared Neve was for an autonomous life. She didn't know how to socialize, was baffled and intimidated by the competence of others, and in awe of all, Beck, Liz, the academics who floated in and out of the house. All's domestic situation she found deeply confounding. If she happened to encounter Liz and all together in the same room, an expression of bewilderment, almost pain, crossed her face. What kind of man puts up with a wife who walks out on him and thinks she can blithely continue under the same roof, coming and going when it suits her? What she really yearned to comprehend, or realized, was how other people negotiated and managed their friendships and relationships. The life she'd known with Lloyd Fanning was one of hidden shoals and vicious resentments. No wonder mother and daughter had seemed meek, silent, blunted when they first moved in. Everyone at Chateau Hall had been patient, however. Not that it was easy. Even now, when all managed to reduce Pia to a fit of the giggles, Neve would dart out and say, "Pia, shush!" in a clenched voice, as if all was a man whose temper might turn. Thinking these things always made him sigh. Monday was Neve's family court hearing, and he'd said he'd attend. Moral support. He sighed again, went to bed, set the alarm for 6 a.m. Chapter 7. Orr's regular morning walk took him around the exhibition gardens and often up and down the back streets of Carlton. He hadn't a lot of weight to lose, and wasn't losing it anyway, but the exercise toned his mind. When he arrived at work that Friday, Claire Pascal raised her head absently, nodded hello, returned to her phone call. Joshua Bug was also there. All hadn't seen him for a few days, was generally glad never to see him. There was something bug-like about Bug. Soft, round, downy. Right now the young detective was leaning back in his chair, eyeing all, his pulpy abdomen ballooning against his shirt buttons, flesh gaping like a row of wounds. "If it isn't old man time." "Hello, Josh," All said. Bug heaved away from his desk and over to All's, yanking out All's chair.
"Here, Gramps, let me help you get seated. You look worn out."
He grinned conspiratorially at Claire, who gave All a faintly sympathetic grimace and said tiredly, "Give it a rest, Josh." Bug looked put out.
"Nice skin off my nose."
He returned to his desk. All was checking his emails. Nothing from Tasmania. When Helen Colfax appeared and told him not to get comfortable, they had a postmortem to attend. She drove, crossing the city to the Forensic Science Institute. A fast driver, focused. But even so, she spotted the old file on All's lap and wanted to know what and why. All shifted uncomfortably. "It's the Elphick postmortem report. I thought Dr. Corrales could give me a second opinion." Seeing her scowl, he added, "Two birds with one stone." The boss's gaze returned to the road. "Elphick isn't urgent, Alan. The verdict was open, if I recall. 5 minutes, that's all. Fresh eyes. Colfax grunted and flicked the car through the traffic. Under the cold, bright ceiling lights, and in the chilled air of the autopsy room, they pulled on ill-fitting smocks and overshoes and waited. A tap dripped. Finally, the pathologist entered with his assistant. Better-fitting gear, and slightly more flattering. Pale green pants, a smock and rubber boots, face masks dangling beneath their chins. The assistant hovered in the background. The pathologist came forward briskly, saying, "Helen, hello. You're attending for the police." Corrales was a tall man, gaunt, a wheeze away from old age. When he shook Orr's hand, he did a double take. "Thought you'd retired." "They can't function without me," Orr said. Corrales crossed swiftly to the autopsy table, spoke his name and the date into the overhead microphone, lifted the face mask over his nose and mouth, and stared at the mess before him. A collection of grimy bones hung with scraps of cloth and dirt. The cheap trainers had fared better. He made a circumnavigation of the table, halting to peer at and lift a couple of bony limbs, noting succinctly his initial impressions of the body. That done, he said, "Now for a closer look." Under his supervision, the assistant removed the footwear and the cloth scraps, placing them on an adjacent table. The pathologist peered at them, straightened, and said, "They don't tell me anything in particular," and ordered them sent for forensic analysis. "Now for the bones." He stood over the skeleton with his hands on his hips and said, "Trauma is present in the rib cage and L5 region of the spine. If one is an entry point and the other an exit point, then a downward projection is indicated." He turned to Helen and Orr. "Was a projectile found with the remains?" All answered, "No. He was buried in soil under a concrete slab. No bullet or bullet fragments. No arrowhead or spear gun point for that matter. Leading us to believe he was shot elsewhere than moved."
"Pity,"
Helen Colfax said. "So he was shot, Dr. Corrales?"
"That would be my opinion, yes. Certainly a projectile of some kind, and more likely a bullet than, say, an arrow."
"Shot in the back?" Helen asked. "The front?"
"Shot in the front, the projectile then nicking the spine on exit."
"A downward trajectory," said Orr. "A taller person?"
"Or the victim was on his knees," said Colfax.
"If I had to put money on it, I'd say he was face to face with the taller person when he was shot," Corrales said. "Now, age. The teeth are a useful indicator here. A cross-section analysis will reveal the age to plus or minus a year. But this young fellow had all his teeth, and there is very little sign of wear. Second, the skull is not fully knitted, indicating a person in his late teens, early 20s.
Height?
The assistant measured it. 172.5 centimeters. About 5'8" in the old scale, Corrales said. But bear in mind the cartilage is contracted and the flesh on his skull and feet has decomposed. So he was slightly taller than that.
5'9"?
Not tall.
Ethnicity?
Caucasian, the pathologist said promptly. The teeth tell us that.
DNA?
You're firing the questions today, Helen, said Corrales mildly.
Sorry, Doc.
This is a cold case.
They're all hot to us, Doc, she said.
Corrales said, as to DNA, I should be able to create a profile from marrow in the long bones, but it will take time to do that and then see if this poor fellow's in a database. He continued to examine the body, muttering, no further signs of injury. Orr glanced around the room restlessly. It was an 8-bay lab. Homicides, suicides, OD cases, accident victims, other reportable deaths. The bodies were stored on steel trolleys in refrigerated units. Even the gleaming steel added to the chill in the air. A movement in the corner of his eye. Up in the glass-walled viewing room, standing at a rail, a couple of students. One waved at him with sly cheek. He nodded back to her. She grinned, nudged her friend.
Okay.
Corrales had finished. He stripped off his gloves.
I'll get the rest of the team onto the bones and teeth and DNA extraction. Obviously, we can't do a toxicology examination. Do you have his wallet, wristwatch?
No,
Helen said. We have a coin dated 2008, all said. Corrales cast a brooding look at the bones. That would fit. Meanwhile, let's hope the DNA gives us something. But he might not be in the system. He is on the young side to have a criminal record. He glanced at the clothing. The shoes might give you something, but they're everyday cheap runners. Helen Colfax had been staring into the distance. Certainly run the DNA, but that'll take weeks, I expect. It would be good if we could release a face to the media. Any chance someone here can whip up a digital reconstruction? Whip up. I like that, Corrales said. I'll need to see if anyone's available. Better yet, has the time. Better yet, has a case number and budget approval. Come on, Doc, all said. Haven't you got any tame PhD students in the building? The pathologist gave it some thought. Actually, yes. They might get a kick out of joining the fight for justice, Colfax said. They might get a kick out of a few dollars, too, Corrales said. And all could see him considering the paperwork, the budget, whom to sweet talk. I'll see what I can do. Before they left, all spread the contents of the Elphick file across an empty autopsy table. Wondered if you could have a look at these, Doc. We could do this in more salubrious surroundings, Corrales said, with a wink for Helen Colfax. Humor the bugger, she said. Corrales bent over the Elphick report, scanned it, and said, My predecessor performed this post-mortem. And reading between the lines, all said, he didn't want to go out on a limb about the cause of death. Corrales grunted. He picked up the file and read aloud. Depressed fracture, left frontotemporal skull. Subdural hematoma, left frontotemporal skull. Lobe cerebral contusion, left frontotemporal skull. He glanced at all. The left frontotemporal skull took a fair old whack. If you say so, Doc. Jaw fractures, abrasions, contusions, lacerations, a broken tooth. Corrales read the rest in silence, the icy air around him antiseptic. Somewhere a sore started. All pictured the ripping of sore teeth and winced. Third left finger fractured, Corrales said. Contusions and lacerations to the left hand, some bleeding with dirt and vegetable matter in the injuries. He looked at all, who said, He put his hand out to absorb the fall. What fall? He was hit on the head, all said, and fell to the ground. Corrales grunted. He read on. He said, Crusted abrasions, both knees, and turned to the photographs. The body, the fence, the ute's interior. All said, As you can see, Doc, blood drops were found in various places between the fence and the ute. On top of the bonnet, and around on the other side of the ute, and inside the ute. It suggests a lot of movement while bleeding. Entirely possible, the pathologist said. He might have had a dizzy spell. It says here that blood, hair, and skin tissue were found on the edge of the rhubarb. He fell, knocked his head on the rhubarb, got up, disorientated, then staggered around a bit. Falling, getting up again. But if you look at the photos, there's an injury on the top of his head. If he was bent over and fell forward onto the rhubarb, that would account for such an injury. Yeah. Meanwhile, there's also blood in the driver's seat, and the driver's seat headrest, all said. He got into the ute at one point. And fell out again. Or was pulled out. First he was hit on the head and fell, hitting the rhubarb. Then got up again and was chased right around the ute, trying to get away. Managed to get behind the wheel, but was pulled out again. That's one explanation, Corrales said, gesturing at the photographs. There are others, equally plausible. Account for the blood on top of the bonnet, Doc. Corrales was silent. Again, the guy fell, hitting his head on the rhubarb, staggered upright, dazed, shaking his head, flinging off blood drops. He paused. But I'm not a blood spatter expert. All, faintly impatient, said, All I want to know is, could someone have hit Mr. Elphick on the head as he stood between the front of the ute and the fence? He fell onto the rhubarb, got up again, tried to get away, eventually climbed behind the wheel, was pulled out again and given another whack on the head, and fell to the ground where he died. Kerala shrugged. It's plausible. No more than that. In the car on the way back to the police building, Helen Colfax said, You heard the man. Give me a couple of days, boss. That's all I'm asking. Chapter 8 Joshua Bugg and Claire Pascal had their heads down when All and Colfax returned. Typing. Making calls. Helen Colfax headed straight for the whiteboard and announced, Slab man, everybody. When they'd angled their chairs in a semicircle, she delivered a fast, concise update. The slab, the body, All and Pascal's door-to-door, the pathologist's findings. So, that's where we stand, she said in conclusion. He was young, no older than early 20s, Caucasian, not tall, and probably shot. Shot elsewhere, then buried under the slab. Bug said, Any idea where? She shrugged. Possibly an old house that was on the property, but it was pulled down some years ago. Shame, Bug muttered. Yes. Missing persons, Pascal said. That's an obvious place to start. I want you on that, Josh. We have a possible first name, Sean. Start no earlier than 10 years ago and no later than 5. If that doesn't pan out, broaden the parameters. Boss? Colfax turned to All and Pascal. Some enterprising reporter's going to wonder who used to own or live at the property. So I need the pair of you to stay a step ahead. Certainly track down the daughter if she's still alive, but also search property records and check utilities. Phone, gas, electric. Who demolished the place? Do they remember blood on the floor? Signs of struggle? Was there ever an old structure over the concrete slab? So on and so forth. Real estate agents, suggested All. They always seem to know plenty. Excellent. The place was a rental at one point, yes? Did any of the local real estate firms handle that? And we need to find Donna Crowther, Claire Pascal said. See if she can explain the boyfriend disappearing from her life. Good, good, we're on a roll. Were Crowther and the boyfriend known to police? Colfax continued. Not only domestic disputes, but were they dealing out of the old house, for example? DNA from the bones, Bug said. There's a backlog, Helen said. And he was a young guy. Quite likely he's not on any database, so we're looking at releasing some kind of facial reconstruction to the public. What about our other cases? Helen gave Bug a smile devoid of pity. I expect you to continue to discharge your obligations in that regard, leading Senior Constable Bug. She paused. You're working Bertolli? Antonio Bertolli was a Mildura market gardener, shot dead in 1978. He wasn't the only one of his profession murdered around that time, the common denominators being the Vic Market and the Calabrian Mafia. The case was reopened every few years. This time it had taken Bug to Mildura for a couple of days, even though a few of the original figures were still alive. Lost cause, All said, before he could stop himself. Words of wisdom from the old geezer, always much appreciated, Bug said. Children, Helen said. She glanced at Claire. You're working Warren? The desiccated remains of Frieda Warren had been found on her kitchen floor after she defaulted on her mortgage and her bank hired a locksmith to break in. He found a skeleton. She'd been dead for 2 years. Her hyoid bone was broken. Every room of the house ransacked. Still looking, Claire said. No spouse, no children, no siblings. She didn't seem to have anyone in her life. Helen turned to All. Alan? Well, Elphick, boss. Backburner, all right? I want you on Slabman. Boss. Joshua Bug was looking at him with an unfriendly grin. Got spinach caught in your teeth, Josh, All said. Late morning now. All and Pascal strolled across the river to the land titles office in the CBD. Expecting bureaucratic resistance, All was pleased they were given quick access to the deeds related to the property where Slabman was buried. Bernadette Sullivan and her husband Francis had bought the property in 1976. Terra Australis Agricor owned it between 2012 and 2015. So Slabman has been there for 10 years. The Sullivans were still the owners when he died, Pascal said. All said, the parents are dead, the daughter inherited. They examined the certificate of title, a stiff document smelling faintly of mould. At the top were the volume and folio numbers, and the quaint address, Blackberry Hill Farm, being part of Crown Allotment 60A. The owners were listed in two columns, with Bernadette Sullivan named as a married woman, and joint proprietor with Francis Sullivan, fire officer in 1976. Then in 1986, Bernadette was listed as surviving sole proprietor. The property passed to Angela, her daughter, in 2011. She later sold it to Terra Australis, who sold it to Nathan and Jamie Wright. Next stop, Angela Sullivan, all said. Back at the cold case unit, they were stopped by Helen Colfax. She gave all an odd look. You remember Bluebeard? All tried to read the look. He's killed wife number three. What's her name, Janine? Not exactly. He's claiming she wants to kill him. Chapter 9. Back when Dr. Alec Neal's second wife died as mysteriously as his first, Al was the homicide squad sergeant in charge of the investigation. His team had never been able to prove anything, but Al, convinced of Neal's guilt, had had a quiet word with Neal's new girlfriend, a hand therapist employed at one of Neal's hospitals. Don't let yourself become murdered wife number three. He'll get tired of you, Janine. He'll meet someone new and he'll fake a suicide or an accident. She'd given him a look of disgust and walked off. All recalled a slim woman, incensed, her gym-toned flesh tight over her bones, her lips a slash across her over-refined face. The way she'd stalked away from him on a tide of vanity and gratification that day in 2012. All, keeping an occasional eye on the pair, heard that she'd gone ahead and married Neal, living half the week in East Melbourne and half on a hobby farm near St. Andrews, less than an hour northeast of the city. Worst case, All thought, he'd see Janine Neal on the mortuary cutting table one day. Best, divorcing her husband, or even giving evidence against him to the homicide squad. The last thing he expected was Neal in fear of his life from her. Colfax told him some of it as they walked upstairs to the victim suite, where Neal had been telling his story to homicide squad detectives. Apparently he found drugs hidden in her car yesterday, and he thinks she used them to kill his second wife, the one she replaced, and his girlfriend. Girlfriend. She died a few weeks ago, suddenly, mysteriously. Before he married her? That's new. Keep an open mind, Alan. The man might be genuine. Not this fucker, All said, remembering the well-groomed surgeon he'd questioned all those years ago. The slender, bony nose steering a patrician, faintly contemptuous face. The calm, monosyllabic replies. Neal staring back across the interview table as if charting and storing the thoughts and feelings of his questioners. They entered the victim suite, a soft, bland expanse of curtained windows and sofa, with books and magazines, a tea urn and a percolator. Forgettable landscapes and cute animals decorated the walls. Neal was seated at a long table with a crumpled-looking homicide sergeant named Debenham, and went rigid when All and Colfax walked in. He pointed a trembling finger at All. What's he doing here? He turned to Debenham. Is this an ambush? I come to you with information about two murders and you turn him on me? Debenham cocked his head at All, who said, I questioned Dr. Neal a few times concerning the deaths of his first two wives. Questioned me? You all but accused me. I got the distinct impression you would have liked to smack me around when no one was looking. You bet I would, thought All. Neal looked different. Still good-looking, well-tended, but raw with emotion today. But then All recalled that Neal had the ability to adjust to situations. Cold in interview, but when questioned at the coronial inquiry following his second wife's sudden, apparently suspicious death, it appeared anguished and self-flagellating. Upset that he hadn't been able to diagnose the illnesses that had taken each of his wives. And here he was, upset again. Neil swiped at his reddened eyes. I don't want that man here. Debenham patted the surgeon's arm. He seemed bored with Neil, as if he couldn't see why he should offer comfort, but knew he had a job to do. Alan isn't here to hassle you, Dr. Neil. He's interested in your accusations. Isn't that right, Acting Sergeant All? Absolutely, said All, ignoring Helen Colfax's warning touch on his sleeve. Neil subsided, glowering. All and Colfax sat in the chairs opposite Neil and Debenham. The first sign you're investigating me, Neil said, I'll call my lawyer. All gave him an empty smile, as Colfax introduced herself. Why don't you fill us in, Dr. Neil? I've already told it 100 times. Not to us. Neil wore a sleek suit, with a white shirt and green tie. He loosened the tie, a busy man undergoing a harrowing experience, and placed his forearms on the table. He smelled faintly of antiseptic soap, and his moist, sorrowful eyes sought Colfax's. I'm frightened. I think Janine intends to murder me. I'm positive she murdered... Let's take matters one at a time, shall we? Colfax said. First, if you think your life's in danger from your wife, we can protect you. And until we can sort this out, you might consider avoiding all contact with her. Do you think? He sneered. I'm driving straight to our country place as soon as I leave here. Janine's staying in the city. She has a conference this weekend. Melbourne University. Okay. Let's go back to the beginning. In 2004, your first wife, Eleanor, died of a mysterious illness. All watched Neil's face. Bewilderment. Then anguish. You're bringing that up? I thought we'd moved past that. Yes, Elle died. She got ill and she died. His fists were two earnest clumps near his heart. These things do happen. Colfax was soothing. I know they do, Dr. Neil. Of course, All had looked into the death of Eleanor Neil while investigating the death of Siobhan Neil 8 years later. The first Mrs. Neil, a hospital admin secretary, then aged 27 and in the 6th year of her marriage to Neil, had suddenly begun to complain of vomiting and diarrhea. A week later, she was dead. Asphyxia. Too sudden to get her to hospital. Colfax said, And then in 2012, your second wife, Siobhan, died suddenly. Also in apparent good health until that point. That's correct, Neil said, shaking his head at what life can throw at you. It was ruled a heart attack, in the absence of anything more compelling. At the time, I thought it was a ghastly coincidence. Unfortunately, that's not what the police thought. He glared at All. However, given the drugs I found yesterday in Janine's car, I now think Siobhan's death was murder. Except I didn't do it, and it's time I was vindicated. All stared at him steadily. Siobhan, aged 32, had been found dead in her bed one morning. The post-mortem found no poisons in her system, no physical trauma, no signs of disease. But there were indications of a heart attack, and that was the pathologist's ruling. Her parents were not satisfied. They approached the homicide squad and, making no effort to conceal their loathing for Neil, pointed to the sudden death of his first wife. All's team weighed it up. One husband, 2 fit, young, healthy wives, one dying after suffering vomiting and diarrhea in the days preceding death, the other of a possible heart attack. Neil had married Siobhan, the speech therapist with whom he'd been having an affair, less than 6 months after the funeral of his first wife. This was generally thought to be bad form, but no one talked about murder. They started to when it was revealed that at the time of Siobhan's death, Neil had been having an affair with the woman who became his third wife. Janine was also married at the time of the affair. When her divorce came through, a week after Siobhan's funeral, Neil sent her 100 red roses. 7 months later, he married her. All recalled the coronial inquiry. Neil claiming he'd been Janine's friend, not lover, at the time of Siobhan's death. In a record of interview played to the court, he'd sobbed. You don't know what it's like to be viewed as a brilliant doctor, yet unable to save the lives of those you love. He'd gone on to say he'd thought long and hard about the events and, yes, was spending a fair amount of time blaming himself. Now all heard Helen say, "Siobhan was murdered, and you think your present wife did it?"
"Yes."
Neil shifted uncomfortably. "I know what you're thinking. You think I'm a serial womanizer. But things were shaky with Siobhan, and I was flattered when Janine started to pay me attention. Then when Siobhan died, Janine was there for me, and I was weak, I admit it. And history repeats itself, and things get shaky with Janine, and you find yourself a new girlfriend," said Orr. Neil flushed. He turned to look at Debenham. "Do I have to listen to this?" "Sergeant Orr apologizes for his tone," soothed Colfax, kicking Orr under the table. "Returning to Siobhan, do you think your present wife killed her so she could have you to herself?"
"Obviously."
"Was Janine around when your first wife died?" Neil was astounded. "God, no. She would have been still at school." Orr suppressed a snort. "I've just about had it with you," Neil said. Orr folded his arms. "Have you been feeling ill recently, Dr. Neil? Vomiting? Diarrhea?" Neil looked at him. "You'd like that, wouldn't you?" "No. Janine's drug of choice is sudden and undetectable. She used it to kill Siobhan, and she used it to kill Christine."
"The bodies just keep piling up," Orr said.
"Who's Christine?" Debenham, the homicide squad detective, gave Orr a bleak smile. "Christine Lancer. A friend of Dr. Neil died suddenly a few weeks ago." Orr opened his mouth, but Helen Colfax kicked him again and said, "Perhaps you could tell us about Ms. Lancer, Dr. Neil?" Neil said primly, Chris was a physio at the Epworth." He made a rolling motion of his wrist. "Naturally, I'm always conferring with physiotherapists in my line of work." "Naturally," said Orr, visualizing Neil's type. Pretty young blondes who looked about 15. And crucially, blondes who were not doctors. Neil didn't want to shack up with an equal. Or indeed with someone who might recognize she was being poisoned. The thought earned him another kick from the boss, who apparently could read his mind. "How did Ms. Lancer die, Dr. Neil?" "I think my wife..." "No, Dr. Neil, leave her out of it for now. How did Ms. Lancer die?"
"It was ruled a heart attack."
"Just like Siobhan?"
"Just like Siobhan," confirmed Neil.
"Do you believe in coincidence?"
"I don't."
"Nor did all." "Are you saying Janine used something in both cases that mimicked the symptoms of a heart attack?" Neil's moist eyes glittered. "I am indeed. And I found the evidence. Sucks."
"Sucks."
He smiled and leaned in. "Succinylcholine. How do you know she used that particular drug?" asked Colfax. "Because I found her stash hidden in her car."
"That doesn't answer the question," said Orr. "What makes you think she used it to kill anyone?"
"Because deaths from succinylcholine reproduce the symptoms of heart attacks." A catch in Neil's voice as he said it, and he swiped at the leakage from his eyes. Debenham gave him a look of impatience tinged with sympathy. All sensed from Helen, too, not exactly sympathy, but a willingness to hear Neil out.
"Tell me about this stash," she said.
"Two ampoules, each 25 mils, one half used, sufficient to kill several wives." All said, "Found in Janine's car. Why did you decide to search it? And when?" Neil shot him a testy look. "Yesterday I went out to buy wine. Janine's car was parked behind mine, so I borrowed it. I was getting out some coins for the parking meter and dropped them. They rolled under the driver's seat somewhere. When I got out and started peering around, I saw this little Velcro bag." Neil took out his iPhone, swiped at the screen, and placed the device face up on the table. All leaned over to look. A dark but mostly clear image of the underside of a car seat and a rectangle of fabric. Leaving the phone in place, Neil swiped again. The bag open, showing a syringe and two ampoules, one full of fluid, the other half full. It was entirely possible that Neil planted the stuff, but all let that go. He said, as though curious,
It doesn't have to be refrigerated? It's stable for a few weeks at room temperature.
Let me play devil's advocate, Helen Colfax said. Let me be your wife's defense barrister. She's a hand therapist, right? Damaged tendons, other painful injuries. One day she's needed the succinylcholine for some reason, maybe an emergency procedure. But the hospital's run out, so to make sure that never happened again, she stocked up. Hid the stuff under the seat of her car so junkies wouldn't steal it or whatever. Neil shook his head dismissively. There's no legitimate reason why a hand therapist would use sucks. It's used in operating theatres. But a skilled surgeon might use it, asked all. All innocence. Neil scowled. Yes, I'm a surgeon, and yes, I'm skilled. Tendons, bones, sinew, nerves. Microsurgery when someone chops off a finger with a bandsaw, for example. But sucks isn't used for that kind of procedure. Sucks is a muscle relaxant used in emergency or critical procedures where it's necessary to intubate. It sedates and paralyzes extremely quickly. In fact, the lungs stop working, but the patient then breathes by way of a respirator. He swung his head from one to the other. Debenham, Orr, Colfax. If it's used in the absence of a respirator, the result is immediate paralysis of the diaphragm. Breathing stops, followed by fatal brain damage, in a matter of seconds. Let's say for the moment we believe you, Orr said. Neil curled his lip. That's it, I want a lawyer. Helen Colfax said, I apologize for my colleague, Dr. Neil, but humorous for the moment. Alan? All said, I merely wanted to ask where you think Janine obtained the sucks. She stole it from the hospitals she works in. Wouldn't they have records? Wouldn't she be found out? Neil said, not if a hospital is missing just one vial. It would be explained away as sloppy paperwork. But if two vials went missing, it would be another story. Thus, to avoid arousing suspicion, Janine took one from the Epworth and one from the Alfred, two of the hospitals she works in. Thus, wanker. It's injected and acts quickly, said Orr. Acts in seconds. Surely there are symptoms, Helen said. Sucks is the perfect killer. It's quick, not much is needed, and the victim gives every indication of dying from a heart attack, Neil said. There was a pretty thorough post-mortem when Siobhan died, Orr said. Why didn't it turn up anything? Not even a good pathologist would think to test for sucks. A specific urine test is needed, which isn't part of the protocol. And the results can be inconclusive. Orr glanced at Debenham. Can we get the pathologist to have another look at this girlfriend of his? Debenham gazed back levelly. Cremated. And there was a family history of heart problems. Convenient. All watched Neil for, what, smugness? Relief? We have two perhaps unexplained sudden deaths and photos of two tubes of some liquid. None of it is proof of murder. Except he knew there had been murder. Murders. Neil said, I can tell from your face you don't believe me. Nor did Sergeant Debenham, at first. I'll lay it out for you, okay? That's what we're here for, Orr said, earning another kick to the ankle. First, I admit, I started an affair with Chris, even though I'm still married to Janine. I was lonely. I hardly ever saw Janine, and when I did, she was cold and remote. Orr opened his mouth, but Colfax got in first. And Janine found out? I left my phone in the kitchen, and Chris texted me one day. Janine read it. She tackled you about it? No. But I could see she'd opened the message. It was pretty frank, you know, sexual. And her behavior changed. Changed how? She became hard and vindictive and had this air of triumph, as though she'd thought it all out. Kill Chris like she'd killed Siobhan, then kill me. Why kill you? Revenge? Well, yes, revenge. And money, of course. After Neil had been escorted downstairs, Colfax, Debenham and all discussed tactics. At the very least, we serve a search warrant on Mrs. Neil, Debenham said. If we do find she's stolen this drug, we can apply pressure regarding the other business. You mean the murders, said all.
Yes. So you believe him? His present wife killed his previous wife and his new girlfriend. Don't give me the shits, Debnam said.